we get things underway by welcoming back to the program from The Athletic, Steve Buckley. Mr. Buckley, good afternoon.
It's quite a guest list you got there.
Well, I mean, starts with the leadoff guy setting the tone for everybody today.
No, Ty Anderson sets the tone for everybody.
Ty's a good man, too. We love all our guests.
Well, it's funny because I was listening to that opening, and the weird thing is the Providence Bruins are playing their games at a youth hockey rink in Middleboro. And I actually wrote a piece on it a few weeks ago for The Athletic. Their weight room and their training room and the locker room is in Providence still at the Dunk. But on game days, they have to, in a series of cars, ride up to this youth hockey center. And a few of the current members of the Providence Bruins played there as children when they were like 9 and 10
wow.
years old. So it's kind of weird.
That is indeed. Hey, speaking of stories that you've had lately, a very interesting piece on Hunter Henry's high school coach, Kevin Kelly, and how he and Bill Belichick got together a few years ago.
Yeah, that was something. You don't want to throw out, oh, Bill Belichick's a genius, because that's been done. And people kind of roll their eyes now because, you know, it's just something that people say, hi, how do you do? Bill Belichick's a genius. And yet we have a case here where, according to the coach and Bill Belichick, he was aware of Hunter Henry when he was in high school because he gets reports, he hears things, he goes on to these streaming networks and stuff. And lo and behold, a number of years ago, Hunter Henry's high school coach was speaking at a football metrics thing at Notre Dame. The next day, the Patriots were playing the Colts in Indianapolis. So he drove to Indianapolis through a mutual friend. He met Bill, and then Bill told him, well, I'm familiar with Hunter Henry. Of course, there were three or four Henry brothers, so it's hard to miss them. But it's just kind of fascinating that Belichick's scouting tentacles would extend that deep into football.
And as much criticism as he gets from some quarters for what he does as Bill Belichick, the general manager, I feel like he enjoys, as much as winning, he enjoys building a team as he's doing right now.
I think you're absolutely right. And in that respect, we can compare him with Red Auerbach, who actually stepped down as coach of the Celtics after, I think, the 68 season and handed the reins over to Bill Russell as player coach. Because the NBA was getting to the point where being a coach and a GM, and by the way, he was also like traveling secretary and assistant trainer, and, you know, and everything else that went on with the NBA in its salad days, as it were. And Red got to a point where he enjoyed constructing teams more so than coaching teams. And just another example was Gene Mock, who managed the Angels and the Phillies and famously never got a team of the World Series. But I did a story on him years ago, and I asked him, I said, what was more difficult, managing the expansion Montreal Expos in 1969 or when you took over the Phillies in the early 60s and they were like 110 loss team? And he said, oh, I loved the Expos because it was building from the ground up. Mm-hmm. Whereas when he took over the Phillies, they had to do a year and a half of tearing down before they could build. And it's just, there are so many examples out there of these people in professional sports who thrive on the science and artistry of building teams as much as they do coaching teams.
Well, one of the things this Patriots team may need is another quarterback. The interwebs all buzzing about Jimmy Garoppolo coming back to New England. Do you think that'll happen?
I think it might because Bill has a time-tested track record of bringing back former players and players who come back in different roles. And, you know, Patrick Chung being one of those players who played a year at the Eagles unremarkably and came back and resumed his winning ways with the Patriots and so forth. So there's familiarity there, and I think that's the key thing. Do I think he'll come back? I guess there are some caution flags. Garoppolo is... he's not a young kid. Remember, he stood in the sidelines holding a clipboard for a long time under Brady. And he's been with the 49ers several years now, and he's been injury prone. So, you know, I guess if you'd asked me 3 weeks ago, would the Patriots go out and sign a gazillion guys for a gazillion dollars? And I would have said no. So I was certainly wrong about that.
You mentioned Patrick Chung. You had a terrific piece on Chung. And how he won by approaching the game and his decision to leave on his own terms?
Well, I use some weird math without doing any research. What percentage of professional athletes at the major league level actually get to, quote unquote, retire on their terms? And then I wrote in the story, is it 1%? Is it 0.1%? Because for every Ted Williams hitting a home run in his last at bat, there are hundreds of players who they get released, they get traded, they get hurt, and they can't really make it back. They get sent down to AAA or some other minor league, or they go to Japan or Mexico, and they always think they're coming back, and they never do. Here's a guy who, in accordance with the COVID guidelines last year, opted out of the 2020 season. He was out for a year. He's getting up there in age, and his girlfriend was having a baby. I think his father was sick or something. There was another family issue. So what he opted to do was get on the phone with Patriots and said, look, I'm gonna call it quits. Very few players. If you spent your entire show on Monday, call us with the names of players who retired on their terms, you'd have to fill for 4 hours.
We're talking with Steve Buckley here on Downtown. Let's move to the Red Sox, about a week or so away from opening day. Can this team be better than we expect?
I know that's the theme that's all pleasant and shiny right now. And as the lover of baseball, me very much wants it to be true. And it's like all of a sudden, as though a gong went off, everybody was saying and writing and yelling toward the middle of last week, hey, this team's going to be a lot more interesting than you think. And that's the snowball rolling down the hill. And again, I'd like to believe that because I'm a consumer of baseball as much as anything else. I still have issues with the starting pitching, especially now with the news that Eduardo Rodriguez is being lifted from his opening day start because of a sore or dead arm. I forget what the phraseology was. And like he was the guy I was counting on for 15 to 20 wins. And, you know, Perez hasn't looked great this spring, and I don't know if Sale's going to pitch at all this year. So, you know, not to stoop the cliche here, but it still comes back to, you know, what's the starting pitching all about? And that's where we are right now. That's where I am.
Absolutely. And you wonder what a guy like Tanner Houck can do at some point this season. He certainly looked good at moments in that lost season of 2020, but who knows?
Exactly. And, you know, when I make my little predictions like we all do in this business, I look at rosters and I just look at the front three. What do you got? Who's pitching opening day? Who's pitching the second day? Who's pitching the third day? Some of that thinking is a little antiquated now because we got the opener and starters go three innings. And, you know, we all know what happened with the World Series last year with the Tampa Bay Rays and Snell. But I still have that habit. I still want to see, you know, some big studs in your rotation, sort of like the Dodgers have right now. It's just like they just have so much starting pitching. I haven't followed it lately, but there was talk of David Price opening in the bullpen because of the depth in starting pitching. And, you know, people used to, like, they'd say, oh, he's an innings eater. And people would roll their eyes, oh, big deal, I can go out and pitch 200 innings. Well, no, you couldn't. That's the problem. And it's hard to get guys who can go out and pitch innings, and even in a lost cause. And I look at rosters and I say, where are the innings coming from? Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a couple of good pitchers, that's fine, but you still need the guys to log innings, and that concern remains for the Red Sox for me.
Now, as somebody who's a baseball historian, you no doubt, as I do, look back fondly on the days when a Lee Stang or a Sparky Lyle might come in and pitch the last three innings of the game, but those days have been long gone. But I wonder, as starting pitchers go shorter and shorter durations out there, might we swing back to a time when you're not investing everything in that short reliever that can only come in the ninth inning and only with nobody on base, and maybe get back to these more diversified skill sets among your relief pitchers?
I think you could see it. And you know, you gave a few back in the day examples, but it wasn't that long ago. Paul Quantrill, who pitched forever. He was good for three innings. And the great state of Maine's very own Bob Stanley, who spent a little bit of time in Maine as a child. But Bob Stanley would routinely pitch three innings. And that was well into the 80s. I don't know off the top of my head if there's pitchers out there that routinely do it now. Obviously, to when I was a kid, Dick Raddatz and the Red Sox would routinely. He pitched like 165 innings one year, all in relief, which is a lot of innings. And it could bridge the gap between the fourth inning, if you're going to take starters out early, and the eighth inning, which is when you get to your setup guys and closers and all that. But I do agree with the general philosophy that pitching is hard to find. Same thing with quarterbacks. They're hard to find. Let's put it this way. I used to joke, without much of a smile, that every team in baseball had one pitcher who didn't belong in the big leagues. And it's changed now with all the specialists and stuff, but you'd come out of spring training, and every guy had that, like, quasi-fifth starter, quote-unquote, long guy, who'd be released by May 3rd. And whoever your fifth starter was invariably was not on the team in June. And just because there's just not enough human beings on the planet that can pitch to major league hitters and do it effectively. So I understand some of what they're trying to do, which is save pitching, but at the same time, it gets a little silly sometimes.
I had a friend who's down in the Washington area sent me a nice gift the other day, and they were a number of old Billy Swift baseball cards. And it got me to thinking, which Mainer had the best major league career? And to me, unless you go back to the very early days of the game, it's going to come down to either Billy Swift or Mike Bordick.
Wow. You could put Jim Beattie in the top three. And interesting, and I love this, the Seattle Mariners had three pitchers in three different decades from South Portland High School. They had Jim Beattie, Billy Swift, and Charlie Furbish.
That's right.
Which is just incredible when you think about that. What are the chances? And I would certainly put those three guys, Billy Swift, Mike Bordick, and I guess Jim Beattie. I think I might go with Bordick, although Swifty had the 20-win season one year, too. I was going to say Bordick had that one big season where he socked a bunch of home runs.
Yeah, Swift led the National League and earned run average one year. I think was runner-up for the Cy Young.
And it's funny because Billy Swift was drafted very high twice, once by the Twins that he didn't sign, and then obviously with the Seattle Mariners in 83. And Mike Bordick does not get drafted at all and signs with the Oakland A's as an undrafted free agent and has obviously a very fine major league career. And, you know, what are the chances that you go through a whole bunch of drafts over a whole bunch of rounds over two or three days, and then everyone else is just kind of sitting out there, and you can, it's just like, you know, like picking apples off a branch. And the A's went with Mike Bordick, and he ended up having a very good major league career.
Yeah, can't go wrong with either one of them. Anyway, Steve Buckley, always great to talk with you. We appreciate you making a little time for us this afternoon. Hope you have a great and enjoyable baseball season. We look forward to checking in with you throughout it.
And real quick, don't forget Ellsworth's Dickie Scott. I saw his first major league at bat in 1989, playing for the Oakland A's against the Red Sox. I was there that night. Every time I see him, I remind him of it.
He didn't have many major league at bats, so that was pretty good that you were there for it.
I was the Red Sox beat writer. I happened to be in Oakland. I saw him before the game, and I actually said the word, "Are you here?" And he said, "What do you mean? Of course I'm here. I'm standing." I said, "No, are you here in the big leagues?" Because he had been kicking around forever. And a whole bunch of guys got hurt. La Russa called up Tacoma and said, "Send me your best glove guy." Dickie was hitting like 213 or something. You can look it up. And he got called up to the big leagues. And that night, against Bob Stanley, in his first swing, it was either a sac fly to left field or a grounder to third, but he drove a run in. His first at bat against the Red Sox in 1989.
All right, but
that was
worth
Dickie Scott.
But did you see the pride of Mexico, Maine, Stan Thomas pitch?
I did not see Stan Thomas. There's a lot of guys. I saw. Oh, there's another one. It's Peter Ladd.
Right.
Was in the World Series for the Brewers in 1982.
Yep.
We could do this all night. Don't get me started.
Well, we'll do it again before too long. Buck, we appreciate you making time for us this afternoon, and we'll catch up with you again before too long.
Awesome. Take care.
Steve Buckley, The Athletic, with us here on Downtown.